Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 58 for Friday, August 28, 2009. This past week here in Ocean Park, Maine, featured some drama on Sunday when I foolishly ventured out to do some body surfing in the big waves sent our way by Hurricane Bill. I did live to blog about it, and you can get the full story at lenedgerly.com in a post that I titled Bill's Waves. Also still with us this week is Bufo Calvin, a prolific and much-loved poster in the Amazon Kindle Forum, who is my guest for this week's interview. Bufo's combined experience as a bookseller and technologist makes him a terrific source for all things Kindle, and at the end of the interview, he granted me a scoop concerning his next venture. So if you're a fan of Bufo's on the forum, you won't want to miss that. In news, Sony finally announces a reader with limited wireless capability, available sometime in December. There's also a new rumor that Amazon will be launching the Kindle next week in Europe, and we're seeing some changes that Amazon has made in the wake of the Orwell situation, as well as a little insight into what exactly caused that problem for them. Despite what you may have heard elsewhere, the Sony Reader is not the only way that you can read one of the million books made available this week in EPUB format from Google Books. My tech tip, courtesy of Andrus Baston at kindleworld.blogspot.com, will show you an easy way to take advantage of this new trove of public domain books on your Kindle. In content, I will preview a huge new biography of Teddy Roosevelt, which prompted a humorous Kindle reference by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. I'll close with your comments this week, including a happy Zoolert user, a link to a funny Kindle review in the Scientific American, and some additional comments from Bufo Calvin. You can subscribe to this podcast at the iTunes and Zune stores or by going to the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. With that, let's turn to the news. Sony this week released two new ebook readers and announced that a third one will be available sometime in December, called the Reader Daily Edition. That one will have a 7-inch touch screen with 16 levels of gray, as well as an AT&T 3G modem. But the wireless capability that you will get with that new Sony reader will only take you to the Sony ebook store. That makes it wireless light compared with the Kindle's 3G connection through Sprint, which enables connection to the web using an admittedly clunky experimental browser. But clunky or not, the Kindle's browser will take you to non-Amazon websites where you can directly download content to your Kindle via the WhisperNet. I've mentioned some of the ways to do this in the past, in past episodes, such as the Magic Catalog of Project Gutenberg, and any of the good Kindle guides at the Amazon store will show you how to do this. Unlike the promised Sony Daily Edition, your Kindle can also check web email for you or send a tweet anywhere there's 3G. The Sony Daily Edition will cost $399, and Sony did not say when in December it will be available in stores. It was odd, I thought, and others thought the same, that reporters at the Sony event this week were not allowed to actually get their hands on the Daily Edition unit, which has always been the case in past demonstrations at Kindle launches. So some have suggested that it's actually maybe more of a vapor reader designed to slow down Kindle sales. If so, good luck with that. One cool thing which Sony's new readers will have is the ability to read books from libraries participating in the Overdrive.com network of public libraries. From a link at Sony's ebooks, ebookstore.sony.com, you can click on a library finder link, and that takes you to an Overdrive page where you can enter the zip code of your local library. You have to have a library card number for the library, which I have for the excellent Denver Public Library, so I tried it out. I couldn't get past the requirement to have an ID number for my device, but I did find, using my Kindle, But I did find that Denver is only offering 100 books for digital loaning through the Overdrive program, and there wasn't a single one that I'd be interested in borrowing even for free for 21 days. So in actuality, it doesn't look like we're missing out much on not being able to participate with our Kindles in the Overdrive network. Still, this whole business of linking from an ebook reader to a library is pretty fascinating, and you have to give Sony credit for being the first one to make even a modest step in that direction with the new models. Lots of coverage of the Sony events in recent weeks, and I think it's pretty clear the heat is on. There's strong competition coming compared to what there's been in the past for the Kindle. But I found an article by a fellow named Scott D. Anthony writing for Harvard Business Publishing titled "The Fallacy of the Kindle Killer." This is on August 27th, and I'll have a link to it. He writes, "That's actually the wrong question. The right question is whether Sony can create a viable growth business with its new reader. I suspect it can," he says, "if its device delivers on the features it promised earlier this week." He argues that Amazon, quote, nailed the business model by partnering with Sprint so customers could get content delivered to their device wirelessly, and Amazon's position as the world's leading online retailer certainly helped its sales efforts by being able to put an ad on the homepage at Amazon for, you know, just constantly. "If Sony delivers on the promised feature set," Anthony wrote, "it has a chance of creating a nice e-reader business. Will it kill the Kindle? Who cares? Remember, the e-reader category is still in its infancy. Analysts estimate that only 3 million devices will have been sold by the end of 2009. Other companies like Plastic Logic have plans to introduce devices. Everyone expects that Apple will jump into the market as well. Amazon surely has more innovations up its sleeve. It's possible that an overwhelming winner will emerge over time," Anthony writes, "but it's equally possible that the category will be big enough to support a number of players. Any company seeking to create new growth should build its business around the customer, not the competition. If you focus on the competition, you can lock yourself into replicating the competitor's last innovation, leaving you gasping for air when they inevitably change the game on you." Pretty good advice, and I suspect that the Amazon team are doing exactly that, keeping their eye on the customer as opposed to getting spooked by what Sony or any of the other competitors may be up to. It certainly makes for interesting times in this segment of the market. As for what Amazon might have up its sleeve, I was intrigued by an item on August 27th from a site called Stuff.tv. Quote, "Well-placed sources have told Stuff.tv that Amazon is working to launch the Amazon Kindle e-reader in Europe as soon as the end of the IFA conference next week." That's a big consumer electronics conference scheduled in Berlin for September 4th through 9th. Stuff.tv reported it could be that Amazon is hoping to get the Kindle over here as quickly as possible in order to win over the market before the launch of Sony's Daily Edition announced in the States yesterday. With its Wi-Fi and 3G connectivity, the Daily Edition could well give the Kindle a run for its money, but while it will launch in the States soon, Sony has confirmed to Stuff.tv that a UK launch is, quote, at least a year away. So I think that's good news for the Kindle, as it gives the Kindle plenty of time to get a head start in the UK and European market before Sony makes its way over there. I just spotted in a new post that came across on Stephen Windwalker's Kindle Nation Daily blog that he read the Stuff.tv item more closely than I did, because the fact that they refer to a Wi-Fi capability on the Kindle shows that they don't really know the Kindle that well, since it doesn't have Wi-Fi. And if they don't know that, then how much credence can you put in their rumor about the launch? So good on you, Steve, for spotting that one. It blew right by me. I'll confess that all this Sony Reader news has left me hungry for another shoe or two to drop from Amazon. I'd love to see rollout of the Kindle in Europe, and leading into the next holiday season, it would be good to see some fun things to talk about regarding the Kindle rather than just the Sony Reader all the time. As I mentioned last week, the addition of the EPUB format to the Kindle would be a very good idea, along with what we've always been urging or hoping that Amazon would do, which would be to have customizable folders to organize our home screens. This is something I haven't actually used a Sony Reader myself, but I hear that is something you can do on the Sony Reader. And there are a few other things that these competing devices have, which I think it just makes sense for the Kindle to add as soon as possible so that we really have the feeling we've continued to have the best device. Finally, in news, we've got some new background information about Amazon's Orwell debacle, which saw the company yank copyright-challenged copies of 1984 from owners' devices, and a big apology afterward from CEO Jeff Bezos. Rick Askenaze emailed me a Our Dear Readers message posted on the Amazon forum from Mobile Reference, which had published the offending copies. Mobile Reference stated in the post that on Wednesday of this week, August 26, Amazon suppressed Mobile Reference books in the Kindle store. Mobile Reference had not yet gotten word from Amazon as to why, but since it was likely the move had to do with the Orwell incident, they offered this explanation on how the mess happened. Quote, we submit books via MobiPocket.com database. MobiPocket.com sells books worldwide. The books are also automatically uploaded into the Kindle store. MobiPocket is owned by Amazon.com, they note. George Orwell's 1984 is in public domain in Australia. Thus, we submitted George Orwell's 1984 to MobiPocket.com for sale in Australia and marked the allowed territories as AU, Australia only. Despite the specification of the allowed territory as Australia only, Amazon automatically uploaded the book into the Kindle store, Mobile Reference says in this post. The book that was only supposed to be sold in Australia was sold in the U.S. We have emailed Amazon repeatedly asking them to suppress the books copyrighted in U.S. from the Kindle store, but received no response from Amazon. Amazon responded on Wednesday, but instead of suppressing a few books, Amazon suppressed all 2,000 Mobile Reference books. Oh well. I suppose there's probably another version of these events from Amazon's point of view, but so far I haven't seen it. There are, however, apparently some changes in their process for digital content. A separate item from the Amazon forum this week notes that Amazon has lengthened the time it's taking to review books submitted for publishing using the digital text platform. Jerry Frank Tuttle Jr. published a book and received notice that, quote, your book is currently under review by the Kindle operations team as we are trying to improve the Kindle customer experience. Please check back in 5 business days to see if your book was published to the store. Others in the Amazon forum said this was a good move, showing that Amazon was going to take more care reviewing DTP items before they go live on the Kindle store. Time now for the tech tip. Andris Bastin in her KindleWorld.blogspot.com blog noted the news that Google this week is making all of its public domain ebook content available in the EPUB format in addition to the PDF format, which they had made available earlier. And she emphasized that this development is not a Sony Reader-only opportunity. In fact, using COVID Goyal's free program Calibre on either Mac, PC, or Linux platforms, you can download an EPUB book from books.google.com and have it available to read on your Kindle within moments. To take advantage of Calibre, you just download it for free from calibre.covidgoyal.net. That's K-O-V as in victory, I-D, David, G-Golf, O-Y-A-L.net. Once it's up and running, you'll come to an easy setup wizard, so Calibre knows how you want your ebooks to be converted and sent to your Kindle. You can also make sure that all the conversion and sent to device options are the way you want them by clicking on the preferences icon at the upper right of the Calibre menu bar. That icon looks like a hammer. You want to make sure that your preferred output format is MOBI, M-O-B-I, which can be read on your Kindle. Once you have all the settings the way you want them, click on Add Books and navigate on your computer to where you downloaded the book from books.google.com in the EPUB format. You should see that the titles from books.google.com that you downloaded have an extension .epub. Once you have your titles on the Calibers program's list of titles and its library, plug your Kindle into your computer with a USB cable. At that point, Caliber on its own should recognize your Kindle by name, and you'll receive a little notice that that's the case. And from once the you can tell the Caliber is able to recognize your Kindle, you simply highlight the names of the titles in the library listing there that you want to transfer to your Kindle, and then click on Send to Device. It will ask if you want to convert the books first, and you click Yes or OK. The Jobs hourglass at the bottom corner of the Caliber screen will rotate while it's working. You can click on it to see the progress of the conversion and the upload to your Kindle. It takes a little while for this to complete, but when everything is done, move your cursor near the icon of the reading device. This is again in the Caliber pane. An upward pointing triangle will appear. Click on that and your Kindle will be safely ejected. You will now see the new title or titles appear on your Kindle home screen, ready for reading. I've been using Anthony Trollope's Barchester Towers for testing various ways of adding public domain content to my Kindle, and I'll confess that the copy I downloaded from Project Gutenberg is much freer of typos than the one that I just did from books.google.com. And even a few typographical glitches I find can really disrupt the flow state of reading. So for items that are available on Project Gutenberg versus books that have been scanned in from something like the Harvard Library into books.google.com, I think I'm going to be preferring the Project Gutenberg just because they're cleaner. But the exciting thing about the Google Trove is just its sheer size, and I'm sure that by poking around in there with doing various kinds of searches, there'll be ways to find scanned material from obscure libraries and other sources that would be fun to have on my Kindle, and because it's now in the EPUB format, I can use Caliber to get it on there very quickly. I'll have a link in the show notes to Andress's explanation of this process at her blog. I think it's basically pretty terrific. Bufo Calvin, and yes, that is his real name, B-U-F-O Calvin, is an author of several Kindle-related titles at the Amazon store, including his bestseller, Free Books for Your Kindle, which has sold about 5,000 copies in the past year or so. I reached him by Skype at his home in Northern California on August 24th, and we'll pick up the conversation at my question about how he priced that very useful Kindle book that he wrote.
The Free Books for your Kindle, that's priced at $2.85 is what the digital list price is, and then Amazon discounts that one. It's been interesting on that Amazon has stopped discounting a number of the digital text platform books. That's a relatively new development. They used to always discount them 20% or more. The reason why it was priced at $2.85 is that I'm a lazy guy, and that comes out to a dollar for me.
I see. So it's easy to figure out.
It's easy to calculate. Yep, I've sold 20 books. It's $20. There you go.
I like that.
There you go.
How did you get any help formatting the books, or did you have enough experience to know how to, because they come off looking pretty well, the ones I've purchased them all to check them out, and they look fine.
Thank you. Well, I actually went back and had to redo some things. I've never really been an HTML guy, although I've been a programming guy, but I didn't really have that much knowledge of that. I started out, as a lot of people might, with Word and saved it as HTML. But Word put all sorts of weird Microsoft tags in there that confused the conversion process. Another person on the Amazon forum recommended to me SeaMonkey. And I know that sounds funny. It sounds like something you should buy out of the back of a comic book. But SeaMonkey is a free internet suite, and it has a very nice very light, easy to use HTML composer. So that's what I'm using now.
The web address for the SeaMonkey site that Bufo discussed in the interview is SeaMonkey, SeaMonkey hyphen project. .org.
I actually now prefer that as my internet browser over Internet Explorer, again, because it tends to be very light and quick, and a nice thing for people who do post to forums, it does spell checking while you're writing online.
You've been really active on the Amazon forum, and could you give me a little history on that? In other words, well, first of all, did you buy your first Kindle One shortly after they came out? What's sort of the early history of your involvement with the Kindle and the forum?
Sure. I got the first Kindle actually at Christmas. It was a present, which was a nice thing, the year that it came out. So that's a while back now. I've always been an active writer, and I had been doing a lot of work with the Sci-Fi-pedia, which was from the Sci-Fi Channel, just as a volunteer, but I had been doing hours a day easily, cleaning things up and writing new material, that sort of thing. Well, Sci-Fi decided to shut that down, and I suppose I'm just as happy they did before they went to that weird spelling that they use now, S-Y-F-Y for the Sci-Fi Channel. Uh-huh. But once they shut that down, I started to look for something more to do, some other place to go. And I got the Kindle 2, in February of this year when it came out. Mm-hmm. And that's really when I fell on the forum, when I happened to run across it. I forget what I was looking for. I'm sure I was looking for something. And ended up going through there and found a lot of fun, informative people, and that's really where I got started.
And how much time are you spending on the forum a day or a week?
Well, let's see. My boss is listening to this. it doesn't really. You know, it's hard to answer that. I have to say, I used to be much, much more involved until maybe a month ago. And what happened was I was just spending so much time there and writing so much there that it became more about me, in a sense, than it did about answering the questions. Hmm. So there were two negatives to it. One was that, and I know this will sound weird, but a whole mythology had evolved about me, both good and bad, on the forum. So when I would post something, there would be always people who would post positive or negative things about what I said. So that was kind of concerning me, for one thing. Then the other thing is I wasn't getting any other real writing done. Mm-hmm. So I was spending at that point hours a day, but it's important for me to say that I'm a multitasking kind of person. So I can be in a meeting mm-hmm. at work and be on the forum and be the most participating person in the meeting at the same time. Now, I would guess that I check on it many times a day, but I probably don't write on it for more than, an hour or so in a day.
Yeah. How come you can't search on the Amazon forums?
That's an excellent question, and it is one of the frequently asked Kindle questions. Here's what I think is actually happening with that. My feeling is that Amazon does more to try and understand their customers than almost anybody else does. So if you could search and find a specific answer to a specific question that had been previously posted, when they go back and read these forums, and they clearly do, they wouldn't know how you were formulating the question, and they wouldn't know how people were answering the question. They would just have a solid answer that they could look at. That would give them some data that said 100 people clicked on this answer this day, but it wouldn't give them the tone and the feeling of what people are doing. They do have search in their official answer pages. So I don't think they look at this as the place where people should go to get answers. I think it helps build the community, which is very important for them. But I also think that it gives them this rich wealth of data about how people are responding and what they're thinking and how they're feeling, actually, about the questions, as opposed to just somebody clicked on, can you organize your books?
Interesting. What if someone were new to the Kindle, say they just bought one and they were taking their first steps into the Kindle forum, what sorts of advice would you have for them on how to get the most out of it?
Right. Well, ideally what you should do is look and see if your question's already there. I know that sounds funny when I just said you can't really search, and there are some third-party ways to search that help a little bit, but it's very common that somebody posts a question when the same question is on the home screen at the same time. So if you're about to ask, can I use it internationally, which is by far the most frequently asked question, if you looked on the home screen, there might already be a thread with that. A thread is just somebody posts a question and people answer it, or somebody just makes a statement and people respond to it. It might be better to take a look right there to see if there are the answers. The other thing is that you should feel free to post the questions. We get a lot of people who say, I've been reading this for weeks and I was afraid to ask my question. Well, I'm not quite sure what they're afraid of. You can certainly get some negative responses, but it's better than having sat there for 2 weeks not figuring out how to charge your Kindle.
Exactly. And when you are answering questions, you've got quite a reputation for being helpful from being there and all. What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to get back to someone fast or thorough, or what's sort of your goal when you weigh in and try to help someone answer a question?
That's a great question to ask me. I've actually changed that over time. Initially, I would pounce as soon as I saw a question. And I am by profession an educator, a trainer. That's what I do. And one of my favorite things in life is to answer questions. That's something I like to do. Well, now I've actually started to try and resist that. And I try and wait until it's been an hour after somebody has initially asked a question before I answer it. And the reason why I'm doing that is to give other people who will equally validly be able to answer the question a chance to do that. I think where part of my strength is in answering the questions for people is clarity in how I express the answer. So I tend to be more thorough than a lot of people are, and that's part of, I think, my training education background, to not just say, well, you drag it into your documents folder. Well, a lot of people who are Kindle users, this is a really key thing, are not techies. They're not computer people. They may not even like computers. One of the things that's really that the Kindle has done that, say, the Sony Reader hasn't done is had people who are not technophiles, people who don't like technology, be able to use the device. So I found that a lot of them don't know what an archive means, or they don't know how to drag it from one place to another. So what I'm looking for is that at the end of answering the question, the person is able to achieve what they were trying to do, even if they don't have a high level of knowledge to begin with. For a lot of people who answer the questions, they're a little, when I have a reputation for patience, they may be a presumptive about what the person knows already. So occasionally I have people say that it feels like I'm treating people like they don't know as much as they do. My take on it is that more people are treating them like they know much more than they actually do. So it's hard to kind of find that middle ground, but I always figure over-explaining is better than under-explaining.
Yeah, and you can probably sort of tell from the question itself what level of experience the person's coming from.
You often can. I mean, you get people, again, who they bought the Kindle or someone bought it for them, more likely, because they're readers, not because they already have an iPhone and they use the Wii for exercise. No, they go for a walk to the park and sit down on the bench and read their 50-year-old crunchy yellow paperback. So for a lot of them, you do get a sense of that when they say things like that, where they'll talk about archiving and not have a sense of what that means. Mm-hmm. It can be pretty clear from the question.
Now, you mentioned the question about using the Kindle outside of the U.S. What are some of the other questions that top the list of most frequently asked?
Well, that's number one. Folders is certainly up there. Why aren't there folders? How do you organize your books? Since the Kindle DX has come out, there have been a lot of questions about the PDFs, the portable document format files from Adobe, which is a popular type of format, about how they use that. It used to be that we got backlight questions all the time. Hmm. That's been an interesting thing to watch, too, that the questions have evolved over time as to what people asked.
What were they asking about the backlights?
They want to know if it has a backlight. They want to know how to turn the backlight on.
Oh, okay.
Right. Again, that's people who are a little bit more from the techie side looking at it than from the book reading side. Mm-hmm. People who are basically book readers obviously don't expect it to have self-illumination. That's just not something that you get when you pick up an old paperback. But the people who are techies, who are used to looking at handheld internet devices, expect it to light up. And that's been one that people will actually get angry about and say, you know, why doesn't it light up? Like, oh, that's not how the device is designed. You couldn't have the e-ink. E-ink is obviously what it uses to make its to make the words and the pictures. And the thing that I always like to point out about that, or I think of it, again, I try to be very polite and not point things out that are unnecessary, but there were many e-readers before the Kindle. None of them were really very successful, the Sony somewhat more than, say, the Rocketbook was. But one of the reasons for that is that you couldn't just sit there and read the device. I mean, if you were somebody used to reading books, it's hard to sit there with a flashlight shining in your face like a 1930s gangster drama when they're trying to interview
That's
you.
That's a great image.
So it's a little easier to read it with this, but that also means that it cannot have a light behind it at this point.
Yeah. Are you, it seems like there's a lot of competition coming. We've got Sony readers coming out soon. I just read that there's I think it's IREX has got a unit that Barnes & Noble is going to hook up with.
Yes.
What's, you and I share a sort of an attachment to the Kindle at this point.
Right.
Do you worry that a year from now we're going to have been backing the wrong horse and that someone else is going to be dominating the e-book market the way Kindle is now?
Not at all, and I can tell you a couple of reasons for that. First, I should also mention that I was a bookstore manager for years, and I'm also a techie going way back. So I do think I have both of those angles on it, both book selling and the technical side. Here's one of the things, is that Amazon has the selection that other people don't have. And that's one of the biggest things for them. And what's going to get somebody who's not a techie to buy an e-reader, it's not going to be the fact that, you know, now I can electronically bookmark a page, because it's just not something that's occurring to them. It's, oh, this one has the latest Janet Ivanovich. So part of what you would have to overcome is people's loyalty to Amazon as a bookseller. And if you look at a place like Barnes & Noble, which is fine, they're going to have a couple of devices that no one's ever heard of if you're not a tech person following what's going on. So you don't say, oh boy, they have a Plastic Logic device. Who makes the Kindle? Amazon makes the Kindle, is what it says on it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we know it really, you know, they don't manufacture it in Seattle, but that's still a big difference to people, that I'm buying from the same person who sells me my book. They're also selling me this electronic thing. And I think that that's a very difficult thing to overcome. Also, just the willingness of Amazon to lose large amounts of money for a long time is legendary. That's always been true for Amazon. It was years before the website itself made money. And people, I actually heard somebody describe the Amazon website as a Ponzi scheme for investors, saying it's, you know, it's not making any money and people are buying these shares and they're never going to be worth anything. Eventually, they were worth a lot.
Yeah.
And what Jeff Bezos said years ago was, you know, when somebody asked him about that, how can you lose money like this for so long? He said, market share will never be cheaper than it is now. And that's true for e-readers.
Exactly.
Market share, when he brought the Kindle in, was cheap because nobody was really interested in it. Now, market share is far more expensive. That's something where I'm happy that Barnes & Noble is rolling the big dice on this one, which they are. They're committing a lot to attempt to do something here. Sony, it's a different situation for them. If you were to say to a Sony executive, well, here's what we want you to do. We want you to sell books at $9.99 that you're going to pay $12.50 for, and we want you to do that for 5 years,
right,
and then you're going to make a lot of money. Sony's going to say, we've got the PlayStation, we have this other stuff, you know, why do we care about losing money on books for years?
Yeah.
But for Amazon, books are what they do. If Amazon failed with the Kindle, which they haven't, but if they had failed with the Kindle, it would be a huge slap in the face for them. This would be, Amazon can't do electronics. If Sony had failed with their reader, it's, oh well.
Yeah, Amazon's you know? Got a lot more riding on it than anyone else.
And so they're willing to be in what Jeff Bezos has referred to as investment mode on this.
Yeah.
So I believe from what I've read that Amazon is likely losing a few dollars typically on every one of those $9.99 bestsellers that they sell, but they're willing to do that for quite a while. Jeff Bezos has said that is a sustainable price into the near future anyway.
Now, I've seen more mention of a Kindle 3 coming out. Abhi at iReader Review was saying possibly even before this Christmas season. If you were giving the Amazon designers tips on what to include in the next great version of the Kindle, what would be tops on your list?
Well, if it was to be a general reader, which is not where I would go next, but if it was to be a general reader, some kind of organization like folders would make a difference. But I think that the Kindle 2 is right now a very successful general reader.
Yeah.
And if you were going to make changes to a general reader, I wouldn't replace the Kindle 2. I'd be tweaking that unit. Mm-hmm. What I think that we may see is more specialized kind of devices. So right now, the Kindle DX is not really designed to be a general reader. It's too big to stick in your pocket, which my Kindle literally sticks in a pocket when I go out. I have big pockets. but the Kindle DX was not designed for that. There are a couple of interesting ways that I think they could go. I think a kid's Kindle would make a big difference. Hmm. It's something that a lot of people talk about is, you know, I'd love to give my Kindle a Kindle to my 8-year-old or 10-year-old, but I don't want them out on the internet without any kind of protection. Hmm. They don't want it where it's going to break as easily. So I think a kid's Kindle would be a market. I also think a Kindle designed for the Spanish-speaking community would be another strong contender. So right now the Kindle can display Spanish books, but it doesn't have, for example, the text-to-speech is not designed for Spanish users, and you could certainly set it up a little bit differently. The navigation could be different. So I can see people saying, you know, is that worth a dedicated Kindle when you're not selling outside of the U.S.? I think it could be. I think that could be a powerful market for them.
Would you need any changes to the keyboard?
Well, you're going to need a couple more letters.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'd need an NA. You'd need a couple more things in there, but it wouldn't be hard to do.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is an untapped market for them. There are right now about 300, roughly, books in Spanish when I checked recently for the Kindle store. But we get that question a lot. I'm actually surprised at the number of times we get the questions about Cyrillic, which is the Russian alphabet.
Hmm.
But, of course, a lot of great literature is in Russian and a lot of great nonfiction is in Russian, a lot of science.
Hmm.
But I don't think they're going to come out with a dedicated Russian version.
Hmm.
Another thing that would be nice is being able to switch the voices more. I think that's I listen to the text-to-speech hours a day. Oh, and here's one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right offhand. Definitely voice navigation.
Yeah.
Right now, the Kindle 2 is a tremendous step forward for people who are visually impaired or who have debilitating conditions like multiple sclerosis to be able to read books. But without the voice navigation, it defeats somewhat the ability to use that book unassisted.
Mm-hmm.
If you have difficulty holding a book, and there are a lot of people who have conditions, CIDP, multiple sclerosis, different things like that, to have to push those buttons to
right.
navigate is a complicated, that's a very complicated gate to get into a beautiful garden. You need to have a gate that's a little easier to work.
Now, one of your books was about specifically about that issue of for the disabled. Do you have
yeah.
any recent information about where that stands with the Authors Guild and the National Federation of the Blind?
Right. That's a really interesting topic to me and a really important topic. There was a boycott of the books for turning off the text-to-speech. And that seems to have slackened up, unfortunately.
That was by Random House because they are the ones that turned it off?
Right now, Random House is the only publisher that I'm aware of, and I follow the issue quite closely, that has actually blocked this capability.
Hmm.
And that is a key difference. A lot of people talk about publishers allowing the capability. When we got the Kindle, Amazon gave us that capability, which was a legal capability. They've been very clear about that. And I've gone back and read all kinds of strange things like the Chaffee Amendment and a lot of copyright law. And it was pretty clear that that was legal for them to do. The reason why the publishers are able to block it is if they have one edition of a given book that is an ebook that is enabled for that. Even if you have to prove you're disabled to get it, even if it's only available from one tiny little source, it's legal for them to block it on the Kindle edition. So what's key here is that they're blocking a capability that already exists, mm-hmm. not that other publishers are enabling it. And that makes a big difference. The DX experiment suit is a different story. That's not saying that there's something wrong with it because it has text-to-speech.
Right.
What's happening in that pilot program, which was partially funded by grants to reduce paper use in textbooks, mm-hmm. What's happening in that is that when you are a college student this year at several colleges, Reed is one of them, Princeton, a number of them are doing about five or six, you'll get a DX at the beginning of the year that's preloaded with some of your textbooks. The argument for the particular student and the blind organizations are working with this student is that the sighted students will be able to use the DX better. It's not that because the DX speaks there's a problem or that it speaks very robotically like a Cylon in the old Battlestar Galactica series. It's because they're not being given an alternative that matches what the sighted students have.
Mm-hmm.
So when a sighted student has a paperback or a paper version of a textbook, the unsighted student can be given something that has the equivalent capabilities mm-hmm. by given a braille title or a different equivalent like that. There isn't something that they can be given right now that matches, say, the search capabilities of the Kindle DX.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what it's saying is that they're inherently getting an advantage by being given the Kindle DX, which will make it more difficult for the visually impaired student to match their production.
Interesting. Well, that's great. I guess one question I had, I've seen people who were active in the forums, Andrew Spassin comes to mind, make the leap at some point to blogging about the Kindle. Is that something you think about as well?
You're getting a scoop. I am going to do a blog. So
you are.
I am, and this is the first place outside of family and friends that I've actually said that. So I've been debating it for a long time, and I am a fairly deliberate person about going through and looking at the options. And one of my concerns, honestly, was having paying subscribers, mm-hmm. because that's going to make it feel more like a commitment to me than something that I do for fun and for the public good.
Mm-hmm.
So that held me back for a while, which my significant other was saying, you know, well, that's a typical male thing, right? You didn't want to commit. we'll let that observation go. But then I have to decide which one. And I was all ready to go with one, and then a very knowledgeable family member said, well, you really should go with this other company, and here's 10 things to look up about it.
Hmm.
So that held me back. But my guess is within the next week I'll probably have a blog, and it will be available through the Kindle store. That's one interesting thing with the forum is that I'll be limited in my ability to announce it there.
Right.
So, like I say, you're getting the scoop that this is
going to
happen probably in a week.
Do you have a name for it yet?
You know, I'll probably use I Love My Kindle, which is the name of one of my titles in the Kindle store. I had started signing things even outside of the Kindle world with ILMK for I Love My Kindle, and that became the name of a title that I have, which is Kindle humor more than anything else,
mm-hmm.
riddles, limericks, literary parodies, all kinds of things. And I'll probably use that as the title of the blog.
I want to thank Bufo for the interview and for all the help he does to help Kindle users on the Amazon forum. I just received an email from him with the web address of his new blog, which you'll find as a new work in progress at ilm, as in Mary, k.wordpress.com. That stands for I Love My Kindle, ILMK. I'll also have a link to his Amazon authors page, which has lots of posts and guidance that he's offered for users there. At the end of our interview, he agreed to do a dramatic reading of a really creative item which he did in the style of a children's fable called The Happy Little Bookworm, and it's about the Kindle and the Amazon forum. It's really a delightful piece. So I'm going to link to that in the show notes, and it'll also appear on your feed if you're getting the podcast in one of the podcatching software systems like iTunes as a separate Kindle Chronicles extra with The Happy Little Bookworm. For this week's Kindle content, I'll pass along a book that I heard about on The Daily Show. It's The Wilderness Warrior by Douglas Brinkley. It's a big, fat biography of Teddy Roosevelt and his role in the environmental movement. And it resulted in a nice Kindle moment on The Daily Show, which is a comedy show, as the author is coming out on the stage to the desk where he has the interview with Jon Stewart. Stewart has this huge tome that he puts on the desk, and it's obviously a very thick book. And he's looking at the book as he asks his first question when the author shows up.
What do you think you're doing?
You need to put it on your library shelf, not the floor.
This thing, I tried to download this to a Kindle.
That's it.
It exploded.
Stewart has a good little interview with Brinkley about his book, which looked intriguing. I downloaded a sample. I haven't actually decided whether to buy it yet, but it does look like it's well written and a really remarkable portrait of Roosevelt that showing him basically as kind of a crazy person, but crazy on behalf of the environment. And looks like a good read if you have any interest in TR. At the end of the segment, Stewart looped back to the basically mocking the size of the book, and he ended it this way.
The book is great. You can read it, and then it opens up and folds out into a bed. The Wilderness Warrior is on the bookshelves now. Douglas Brinkley!
That's this week's item about content. If you would like to buy the hardcover version of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America, that's the hardcover version that folds out into a bed, according to Jon Stewart. That will cost $20.99 at the Amazon store, and it will cost a little bit of trees to get it to you. But there is an alternative, of course, we know, and that's the $9.99 version on Kindle, also available at the Kindle store, and I'll have a link. Time now for your comments. Mary Hundle emailed, "Just wanted to let you know that I used Zoolert for the first time and it worked like a charm. I saw Richard Russo's latest novel was priced at over $14 for the Kindle edition, and as much as I wanted to read it immediately, I set up a Zoolert account and hoped I wouldn't have to wait too long for the price to drop to $9.99. Much to my surprise, it didn't take long, maybe a week or so. I received an email from Zoolert that my price had been met on Amazon. Thanks so much for highlighting Zoolert. I've learned so much from your podcast and appreciate having a go-to resource in the form of the Kindle Chronicles." Thanks, Mary. And that website, if you didn't catch that episode where I talked about it, is Zoolert, Zoolert.com. Bob Lee emailed, "I was just reading my hard copy of the September 2009 issue of Scientific American magazine, and on the last page there was a whole article by Steve Mirsky about the Kindle. Sure enough, it is already posted online at their site. It's a light treatment of the Kindle, mainly favorable, with some funny parts, and including this one. 3 decades ago, I bought but still have not read a copy of The Brothers Karamazov, which sits on a shelf at home. Now, with the Kindle, in less than 5 months, I already have not read the electronic edition of The Brothers Karamazov on 3 continents. So just because you've got it on your Kindle doesn't mean you're actually going to get around to reading that classic, despite your good intentions. Bufo Calvin emailed me the following comment, which actually prompted me to invite him on the show as this week's guest. He thanked me for mentioning his title, Frequently Asked Kindle Questions, in the last podcast, and says, "Andrus alerted me to it. I'm not much of a podcast person typically. I do use the text-to-speech quite a bit, hours a week, and have put old radio shows on my Kindle for plane flights. However, I've never gotten into the habit of downloading podcasts." Well, I hope that'll change now, Bufo, that you'll be a regular listener to the Kindle Chronicles and help spread the word. He continues, "The plane flights are also where I've used Minesweeper. If it's a long trip, I like a little variety."
One important comment on the sleep mode pictures, Bufo continues. This is something I mentioned in the tech tip last week. Changing them on the Kindle One did not require a hack, although it was unsupported. It was possible to do it all within the existing system. The hacks for the Kindle 2 and the Kindle DX appear to require modification of the software, which would be a violation of the terms of service. I find that a significant distinction. I'll note here that Bufo may be correct that a strict by-the-book interpretation of the terms of service might lead you to shy away from the screensaver hacks for the Kindle 2 and DX that I mentioned last week. But I myself take considerable comfort from Amazon Kindle Customer Services post on March 2, 2009, which stated, customer service does not support or provide instructions for adding custom images to your Kindle to be used as screensavers. However, should you choose to do this on your own, it will not void your warranty. Well, now, while that doesn't specifically warrant that the hack does not violate the TOS, I doubt Amazon would go to the trouble of calming hack users on the warranty issue if Amazon's lawyers were at the same time viewing the hack as a serious violation of the terms of service worth losing sleep over. And for myself, I'm so happy to have my own photos as screensavers on my Kindle 2 that I'm willing to take whatever risk I might be running by taking advantage of the hack, which you'll find more information about in last week's show. Bufo continues in his comment, I haven't read Michael Saringhouse's article yet. This is also, this is last week on the legal issues relating to the Kindle, but I appreciate the heads up. I'll look forward to the full paper later. I find the key point is that consumers have never owned the book. He's talking about the paper book. What they have owned in the paper world is a copy of the book, and they still had significant restrictions. For example, if someone photocopied a paperback, or P-book, as I prefer for equity reasons, and sold it, that person would be in violation of the license. Well, the laws, but the license is typically printed in the beginning of the P-book as well. I found that the licensing from the Kindle store works better for me than the way it was with P-books. With three Kindles in the family, we get more advantage out of the typical simultaneous licenses than out of being able to sell the container, the paper, and ink. That's from Bufo Calvin. You can leave me an audio comment by calling 206-666-2713. I really love getting audio comments and putting them on the show. You can email me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave a comment on the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. There have been a lot of good comments on the show notes page, so be sure to check those out. If you would like to be included in my Kindled Spirits email alert list, please drop me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. I send the people on that list an email the moment that I've uploaded a new episode, as well as occasional alerts on late-breaking Kindle news. Once in a while, I'll also send out a request for help to the Kindled Spirits for ideas for questions for one of my interviews. I've done that both times that I interviewed Ian Fried from Amazon. I want to thank those of you who have voted for my proposed Kindle panel for readers and authors at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference in Austin, Texas in March. And a special thanks to those of you who left written comments at the panel picker page. The voting on this will be open until the end of Friday, September 4th. So if you are listening to this podcast before then and you've got the time to help me out, the way you do it is to go to sxsw.com/interactive and then look for a link to vote on panel proposal ideas. You'll have to create a free South by Southwest account to participate in it, but you don't have to have any intention to go to the conference. They're just looking for a sense of which proposals might have some interest. And I think there are over 2,000 proposals, and they'll be winnowing it down to about 300. I won't make any money doing this. I'll get a slightly reduced rate on my registration, but I figure it'll be a great way to connect with people around the Kindle at a major conference. There'll be about 10,000 people at that conference in Austin, South by Southwest.
Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from Ocean Park, Maine for the Kindle Chronicles. Our stay here in Maine comes to a close in a couple of days, and next week I'll be working on the podcast mainly during a quick return trip to Denver before we take up back in Cambridge, Massachusetts the week after. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.